Hello and welcome to Dialect. You're listening to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, at our Friday afternoon 2pm slot on BCFM 93.2. This week, we speak to Jackie Thompson, who worked in Haringey as one of the people part of social services there, with the baby P case, a bit of an inside view of social services. Plus, we have a look at investigative journalist Duncan Campbell's, one of his books, a couple of other book reviews too. Plus, we're talking to Jason Yannakopoulos this week about Victoria Broadrib, which he'll explain later, plus his encounter with Theresa May. Plus our weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect's produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. The phone number is 0117 989 7733. Dialect also recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753. And we'll have the number of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show.
We'll drink a drink a drink to Lily the Pink, the Pink, the Pink, the Saviour of the human race. For she invented medicinal compound, most efficacious in every case.
Mr. Fleas had sticky out ears, and it made him awful shy. And so they gave him medicinal compound, and now he's learning how to fly.
Brother Tony was known to be bony. He would never eat his meals, and so they gave him medicinal compound. Now they move him round on wheels.
He'll drink a drink a drink to Lily the Pink, the Pink, the Pink, the saviour of the human race. For she invented medicinal compound,
Caesar, and so they put him in a home, where they gave him medicinal compound, and now he's emperor of Rome.
Johnny Hammer had a terrible sister stammer. He could hardly sustain a word, and so they gave him medicinal compound, now he's seen.
Medicinal compound, now they call her Millie B.
Jennifer Eccles had terrible freckles, and the boys all called her names. But she changed with medicinal compound, now he joins in all the games.
Despite a medicinal compound, sadly Pickle Lily died.
Up to heaven her soul ascended, all the church bells they did ring. She took with her medicinal compound. Yeah.
1968, The Scaffold there with Lily the Pink. I think a slight, I don't know if you agree with me, Jason, but a slight reference there to hallucinogenic substances, this medicinal compound that's supposed to sort everybody out, because 1968 was one of the years when this was very much in fashion. What do you think? Is that...
I think that's a fair. I think that's a fair thing to say.
Okay,
I'd say what the medicinal compound was. So.
They were being a little bit vague about it, weren't they? probably the best documentary done about hallucinogenic drugs and LSD was done by the BBC back in the early 1980s. Really, before they lost the best. I mean, it's like Harold Wilson was a sort of people's prime minister, and we lost him in the 70s, and in the 80s we lost the people's director general at the BBC, who was Alistair Milne. But this documentary was made around about the same time as he left, and the sort of, I suppose the corporate people hadn't kind of moved in by this point. And here's an extract now from a BBC documentary about LSD called The Beyond Within.
Many young people, lacking secure belief but living secure lives, felt a spiritual dimension was lacking. For them, this bus came to symbolise psychedelic liberation. LSD was the ticket to ride.
I believe with the advent of acid, we discovered a new way to think. And it had to do with piecing together new thoughts in your mind that produced people like Bob Dylan and John Lennon and William S. Burroughs, that were using new images together in a way that jarred the mind and produced images that were latent in our consciousness, but were not being brought about by reading Vanity Fair or Woman's Home Companion.
Author and grand prankster Ken Kesey was a leading voice in the 60s chorus extolling the virtues of LSD. With money from his first novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Kesey and his friends bought a second-hand school bus, painted it bright colors, and loaded with LSD, set off across America.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
Well, that was a little extract there for the little song from Bob Dylan, an extract, Jason, from this BBC documentary, The Beyond Within. Actually, just a little bit of a diversion, because I just happened to have that clip with me after playing Lily the Pink, and that's what I was thinking about. Actually, you've come in today to talk about something completely different, which we mentioned at the start of the show, didn't we? This woman, Victoria Broadrib. So can you introduce her? Who was she?
Victoria Broadrib was a Paralympian, not too long ago, actually competed at the 1996 and Sydney 2000 Paralympics. And she is an extraordinary person, because when she was born, she had a very, very rare disability, which unfortunately has such a long name, because it's a really medical one that I can't pronounce it. But she was only one of three people in the country to have this disability at her time of birth. And she is absolutely, it's absolutely astonishing, because she's got with education at first, of course, that her cartilage of her body didn't form properly, and so she had to be in a wheelchair all the time. And back then, a lot of schools didn't have the sort of access to disabled people that we have now. So that for her was very difficult, but. She was ridiculously tiny. What she didn't have in leg power, she had in arm power. And so she took up swimming, and she was very, very good at swimming, to the point that by the time she was in sixth form at Alton Sixth Form College in Birmingham, which is where she was grew up, she was spotted by some people from Disability Sport, who touted her name to the Paralympics GB team, and she was selected initially for Atlanta in 1996. And at that time, the Olympic team hadn't actually seen her, so she was put in for, I think it was S3 or S4 category swimming, and they hadn't actually realised how small she was at the time. When they saw, they realised it was a misclassification. But She's put in people who are more able than she was and still managed to come out with a bronze medal, which is absolutely astonishing.
So how did you first hear about her?
Well, she was my cousin.
Oh, really?
Her father was my mother's brother. It's astonishing. She set three world records after that, and she won the gold 4 years later in Sydney, correctly classified an S2 this time. And unfortunately, she never got to defend the title in Athens, because she would have been defending the title in Athens, which is my hometown. That, in a sense, that's where I was born. She died the year beforehand, unfortunately.
Okay, what was she like as a person?
She was really courageous, is all I can say. She really would not let anything get in her way, you know. She was born in 76, so she was... So she was a child in the 80s, and just... She always told me about how things are difficult, and this is at a time in my life, the point when she was really successful, the time in my life that was probably the most difficult. And so she was a big inspiration to me, because I was finding things difficult, and she says, "You were," and she always told me that I will find things difficult, but if I keep a state of mind, if I keep strong, I can push through. She's my cousin, so she knew me throughout my life, and right from the start, because I knew her right from the start, I never really thought anything different about disabilities, because she always seemed so much like everyone else. So for me, I think I think probably the thing that affected me most was her death in 2003. It was we'd known it was going to happen for about a year. She knew it was going to happen, because all her life she'd been told by doctors that she was living on borrowed time, which I think is actually a really horrible thing to say at the start, even if it's justified. But
well, to a certain extent, we all are, aren't we?
We all are, and for me, that was shocking, because I just had a road accident myself at that point, and was going through a stage of recovery. So as soon as I was out of the hospital, she was in. They'd had an issue where she was doing a swimming thing in Finland, and she wasn't able to complete the course. And we knew back then that because cartilage didn't form well in her body, we knew that there was going to be a problem. And sadly, she died, and I was absolutely hit for days. And I remember it wasn't too long before I had to sit some mock exams in January, and actually did ridiculously badly because it affected me, because she was such a huge inspiration for me.
Well, she's obviously, I think, an inspiration for others too. But how do you think she's actually different from this year's Paralympics and the Paralympians in London?
It's a really interesting point, because no one knew anything about her. Even then, because Paralympics wasn't really covered to a great degree back in back in the late 90s, early 2000. In fact, really, it's only been covered this year in London. Only this year has it actually had any form of massive impact to the British public. So hardly anyone knows about her, even though she was so phenomenally good, to the point where 9 years after she died, she still holds the world record for S2 swimming. So I think that's the difference, because this year's Paralympians are going to get an awful lot of press, and may all become quite famous, because that all depends on the future. But for her, it was just always a shame that no one had ever heard of her, and she'd done so many wonderful things. She got an honorary degree from Birmingham Uni, she got an MBE, and no one ever covered, and no one really covered it, because it was in Sydney, so the events were happening like in the middle of the night here, so no one saw it. And when she died, no one covered it, none of the national newspapers, not even the BBC. And I think it's a real shame, because she was a phenomenal talent, and yet she never really got I don't ever think she got the respect that she deserves.
So anyway, what do you think is the future of disabled sports nowadays? I mean, the thing is, Victoria was around at a time where, before the Paralympics really became this massive publicity thing. So, you know, that's one change. But what do you think is the future for disabled sports?
I sincerely hope that this is the start of Paralympic sport becoming something big. But for that to happen, there's going to have to be coverage of Paralympic sport outside the Paralympics. You know, like you get places like Eurosport and BBC, they cover the athletics even outside of Olympic time. They cover all these Diamond League meetings and things like that, and Eurosport especially does that. But for it to be an absolute success, I think we're going to have to see Eurosport covering Paralympic events outside the Paralympics. And also, it all depends on how it's covered. Maybe not 4 years down the line, because it will still be covered to a great degree, because of course all the success of British athletes. But when the British Paralympians who won in this Paralympics retire and new ones come through, we're looking 12, 20 years down the line. I think really we can only judge when we see that, whether to see if this Paralympics was a one-off or whether it really is the start of something new. I sincerely hope that this is going to be something new. But for it to be successful for Paralympics GB, the government is going to have to invest a lot more in disabled sport, which they're not doing at the moment.
Well, okay, so we'll have a chat with you in a minute a bit more about, but this time changing subject and talking about Theresa May.
Ah, my local MP.
After some more from the scaffold.
Thank you very much for the song we joined.
And our cultural heritage.
National beverage.
Being fat.
Union Jack.
The nursery rhymes.
Sunday Times.
The nap and bomb.
Everyone. Thank you very much. It was simply spiffing and true. Now let me whisper, I love you. Thank you very much for the Aintree Iron. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the Aintree Iron. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for playing this record. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for playing this record. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for our gracious team. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for our gracious team. Thank you very much.
That was The Scaffold again, this time a little bit earlier, from 1967, not 68, and thank you very much. Now, just while that was on, we were looking up online, Vicky. It's VI, if you're interested, you can look her up on VICKI, Broad Rib, that's BROADRIBB. And Jason, I didn't realise she had an MBE.
I did mention she got an MBE after winning the gold medal in Sydney. So, she got an MBE, and that's actually the medal that we did keep, was the MBE. We didn't actually manage to keep the Paralympic gold after the death. That went back to Paralympics GB.
Okay, now, also, I was, you know, listening to the song from The Scaffold there. Thank you very much for our team. So, Vicky Broadrib was definitely on the team. I always thought they said thank you for the Queen, but no, obviously not. It's the team. Thank you very much for that. Scaffold. Anyway, Jason, you've come in particularly today. One of the things is to talk about We're still trying to get you your disabled show on here. I'm sure we will at some point in the future. But to talk about Theresa May, because you are actually living in the Home Secretary's... I'm not sure if she'll still be the Home Secretary when this broadcast goes out on Friday. You're never quite sure. But at the moment, she still is the Home Secretary, and her name is Theresa May. When did you first come across her?
Theresa May is actually... I live in Maidenhead. Theresa May is actually my local MP. So I've met Theresa May a few times. First time I met her was at the boathouse. Was that a boathouse by the Thames in Maidenhead? Maybe just outside Maidenhead. It's a really ridiculous story, because I was part of an autistic group of children called CATS. I can't even remember what that stood for now, but it was dedicated to children with Asperger's syndrome and autism in mainstream schools. And our little group had been given some extra funding by the council, and the council asked Theresa May to present us with a cheque, so we had to meet her at the boathouse. And because I was the oldest kid at the time, being the only one of voting age at 18, I was also on the board for it, so representing the actual members. So I was asked to go and receive the cheque from Theresa May, and we were all there in... This is brilliant. We were all there in our wellies waiting for Theresa May. She turns up.
Hang on a minute. Why were you in your wellies then? Was it a bit muddy?
Well, it was at a boathouse. It was right by the River Thames, so it was very muddy. We were on our Wellington boots. Out steps Theresa in her leopard print stilettos, and she actually sinks a foot in the mud and requires her two aides to lift her out
halfway up to
it, and then had to tiptoe her way into the building. And I was 18. I was voting age. This is 2005, the time of the previous general election, and I was like, and this woman wants me to vote for her.
Okay, so she was halfway up to her knees in the mud.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so what about other encounters with Theresa? Have you had any more since then? And, you know, what do you think of her generally?
I've had a couple since then. I have to admit, I'm not amazingly impressed. I know that the group that... A group I know of who represent Asperger also in Maidenhead sent her an email and didn't get anything back. She, really, a lot of the scene, I think she's been a terrible local politician, because I've been watching her on BBC Parliament, and she's never ever mentioned Maidenhead or even anything to do with the town. She doesn't actually, she lives just within the constituency, so where she lives is Sonning, which is on the constituency boundary.
So what is that, a little village or something?
Yeah, it's a little village near Maidenhead. Not actually in it. It's actually not that close to Maidenhead. It's not even in the Royal Borough of Windsor and Maidenhead. It is in fact in Reading Borough Council. So it's not actually part of the Royal Borough, but it is in the Maidenhead constituency.
Okay, so where's her constituency office then? Is that actually in Maidenhead itself?
Not in the centre, it's a bit more out in the sticks.
Okay.
So it's not actually... I thought it was in the Maidenhead Conservative Club, which is in the city centre, but it's not.
Okay. Well, we've got a few books also to look at this week. A pile here. The first one on the top is this one, War Plan UK. Now, I don't know if you've come across this, Jason, but
I haven't.
This is something that's... Well, it's not all that easy to get. I think it's about... Well, first of all, the author is... The author is one of my favourites, is investigative journalist Duncan Campbell. He made a series for the BBC in the 1980s called Secret Society, which was all about just how secret our political system is. Funnily enough, the next year the Director General got sacked. One of the particular programmes was about the Hidden Constitution, I remember, and that was to do with how secret cabinet subcommittees make all these big decisions, like about nuclear weapons, and even members of the cabinet are not allowed to know who's on those committees and not allowed to see any of the minutes of those committees. And the way that so many of these decisions are presented to the cabinet to make decisions on in secret.
Whoa, I knew nothing about this.
Well, this is Secret Cabinet Committees, and that was one of the two programmes in that series by Duncan Campbell for the BBC, backed by the Director General Alistair Milne, who was then sacked. The other one, I mean, that was big enough, but the other one was one about a £500 million spy satellite, which the military had managed to smuggle past the Public Accounts Committee by getting the budget and splitting it up into little bits and smuggling it past. And so the Public Accounts Committee didn't even know this spy satellite had been put into orbit. And
that's so clever, aren't they?
But that was Duncan Campbell's way. I mean, basically, he would come out with all these kind of things. But this book, War Plan UK, is subtitled "The Truth About Civil Defence in Britain." The reason I
bet he's listed as a conspiracy theorist.
Well, probably, but he's done actually he's done work more recently for the European Parliament looking at it's called "Assessing the Technologies of Political Control," which is looking at spying on mobile phones and landline phones and the ability of certain people in our society to be listening in to the phones of MPs. I mean, in Greece, for example, Vodafone were found to have been spying on, as you may know this story, being half Greek, spying on the Greek politicians.
That's right, yes.
You remember that one?
That one caused a big in the parliament in my home country.
Yeah. So, and also, I mean, of course, for me, the question is: are Vodafone spying on us? You know, in Britain, all our politicians and our decision makers and our opinion formers here.
Definitely, I reckon.
So, but the point of bringing the book in really was to have a little discussion about civil defence. Civil defence is something which was post-war, really, to do with the Cold War, where there was a lot of equipment there to make sure that if there was some kind of attack on Britain, that people would be looked after in one way or another, bunkers, this kind of thing. And that all got turned around into something called the Civil Contingencies Act and various other things. But we don't really seem to have a proper civil defence programme anymore, which bothers me. I mean, you know, I think we should have something like that. But the point of the book was, really, that Duncan Campbell exposed. And obviously you can still get this on places online like bookfinder.com, was that, and I'm not actually plugging them because we're getting anything from them, it's just one of the best book search websites I've found, is that one of the shocking things about this was just to what extent Britain is really beholden to the United States. Because what the US was saying is if there is any Cold War in Europe, some kind of conflict with the Russians, as it was back in the 1970s and 80s, that basically the US would take control of Britain. But we've had something very different.
Whoa, what?
Well, it would take control of, you know, a lot of our, for example, British citizens would be used to work towards the US plan for the military war effort, this kind of thing. And the actual infrastructure of it is all laid out in Duncan Campbell's book. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the reasons why there was such a lot of sensitivity around Duncan Campbell at the time. There is another Duncan Campbell who's a crime writer at The Guardian, a separate Duncan Campbell. But that was, to me, one of the most explosive and mind-bending TV programmes I'd ever seen in the 1980s. I would have been about 20 or 19, something like that. And I remember watching that at the time and thinking, wow, this is what television is all about. But we don't really get that kind of investigative journalism much anymore. A lot of the investigative programmes are just not there. You know, things like World in Action. We had a programme called This Week. We've just about got Panorama still. We've got one or two, but nothing like the big broad spread of investigative documentaries. I mean, each channel, three, four channels, each channel had at least two big, you know, and they would basically compete with each other, these investigative documentaries, to get the story before anyone else. I mean, for example, when there was an assassination by the SAS of IRA terrorists on Gibraltar, I mean, the state is actually supposed to arrest people and try them for terrorism, not just assassinate them, but that's what happened in Gibraltar. Within about 10 days, there was a documentary about it on the TV. Nowadays, we get virtually nothing. As Richard Cottrell was telling me recently, I interviewed him on here, he was saying how he believes investigative journalism is dead in Britain. But to realise what you don't know, Duncan Campbell's one of the best places to start, and his book I've been chatting about is War Plan UK, The Truth About Civil Defence in Britain. Of course, it's a bit out of date now. It's probably 20 years out of date, but it's still fascinating to see what at the time we didn't know. What do you think? I mean, what are your thoughts about these topics about investigative journalism, Jason?
I think investigative journalism is something that should be protected rather than eradicated. You know, it's something that if there is something deep and dark going on behind the scenes, then the public have a right to know about it. Here's a question for you, Tony. Do you think the reason that investigative journalism is so-called dead in inverted commas, because of course we can't really call that, do you think this has anything to do with the government? Do you think the government have cracked down on this?
Well, certainly the decision to sack the Director General wasn't actually directly the government. This is back in 1987. The Director General that gave us this series, Secret Society, and Duncan Campbell put together, he did a thing about data protection as well, way ahead of its time, before the Data Protection Act had ever even been thought of. One of those programs was about just how much information is being kept on individuals. And, I think now what we've got, these massive databases being sold, even information being sold around the world to big corporations, by one corporation to another, MI5 having a conference, getting in loads of big businesses. This is a few years ago now, an article in The Independent, to say to them, you know, what can we do for you guys? You know, we would like some money and you can pay us and we will do things. This is really almost like turning the British intelligence networks and the intelligence services into a kind of mercenary army almost. So that is, you know, that's also a little bit worrying. But Duncan, what I'm saying is Duncan was flagging a lot of this stuff up back in the 1980s, the way this was going. Anyway, I think it's very important, investigative journalism, quite clearly. You know, I do a bit myself, and, I think there's a lot going on out there. We've found out, you know, over the last few weeks with the Jimmy Savile scandal, that quite horrific activities can be going on right at the centre of the BBC. People can be reporting this to the police. Nothing's done about it. And I think it was 7 times the Sun said that Jimmy Savile was led off by the police. So we've got a bit of a crisis. If your mainstream media and your police are colluding in covering up criminal activity, then there's something rotten at the heart of your nation. And I suppose at least there's a lot of material for investigative journalists to get their teeth into, and a lot of this stuff you'll find online. Anyway, before we go on to listen to Jackie Thompson and hear about the Baby P scandal and Victoria Columbier from inside Haringey Council, some more music from The Scaffold.
Why don't you behave just like other girls do? Why must my poor heart keep following you? Stay home and love me, my Liverpool Lou. When I go walking, I hear people talking, school children playing, I just know what they're saying. They're saying you grieve me and that you deceive me. Some morning you leave me all packed up and gone. Oh, Liverpool Lou, lovely Liverpool Lou, why don't you behave just like other girls do? Why must my poor heart keep following you? Stay home and love me, my Liverpool Lou. Thank you.
on the river. Keep telling me ever that I should forget you, like I never met you. Oh, tell me the song was never more longer. Please say I belong to my Liverpool. Why don't you behave just like other girls do? Why must my poor heart be following you? Please stay home and love me, my Liverpool.
My name's Jackie Thompson. I'm a former employee of Haringey Council. I'm not from the social work side, but I did work for social services. My concern isn't specifically about Baby P, it's about childcare in general. My specific case originated from the management arrangements concerning Victoria Klumbi case.
Yeah, can you just remind us about both those cases?
The Victoria Klumbi case was in 2000. Victoria Klumbi was a West African child who came to Britain with her great aunt, under the care of her great aunt, under the, I believe it was the Treaty of Rome, Rome Treaty. She was cared for. She was on the child protection case at Haringey Council. And, you know, she was brutalised and died tragically in 25th of February 2000. And as a consequence of that and the under-resource and underfunding of Haringey Social Services, Haringey were placed on special measures. They did admit to failings in Haringey Council. There was a huge inquiry. And as a result of that inquiry, there were many legislation that were brought in to protect vulnerable children, carried over into the Baby P case. You'll recall the Lemon inquiry.
For some reason, this particular case was left for a long, long time without actually being dealt with by social services. And what's happened is there's been changes now that have meant that a lot more children, maybe actually children who are far less necessary to take into social care than Baby P, are now being taken.
I don't really understand that much of the legislative side of the Baby P case. My involvement was really to do with the back office functions. And, of course, since Baby P, that's come more to light. Now, the majority of people be aware of the Baby P whistleblower. I can't recall it. I think it's Nazris Kamal. But what few people realise is that, or recall, was that there was actually a special measures whistleblower, which was Rose Casino. Now, Rose Casino was the team manager of the North Tottenham District Office, and that was the office that was responsible for the care of Victoria Klumbi and Baby P. And of course, she had direct involvement with the Victoria Klumbi case. Now, she raised concerns after the death of Victoria Klumbi that the services were not improving, the funds, adequate funds were not there, and she raised concerns with the then director of social services that another Baby P case could happen once again. And of course, it did. You know, seven years later with Baby P. And it's interesting to note that the very same leader of the council who was leader at the time of Victoria Klumbi, George Meehan, was also leader of the council at the time of Baby P as well.
So give us an insight into the back office function at Haringey, because it sounds in total disarray.
Well, that's because since the introduction of the target culture, which is the performance government that was introduced by Tony Blair, that was the the reform in public services, we then actually move from substantive care to this style over substance culture, which is the target culture. And what you then had there was that the focus went more on the tick box functioning as opposed to making sure that you had direct contact with the vulnerable children. You did empirical interaction with the carers, and you looked at the case substantively. The focus really was making sure that boxes were ticked to give the illusion that services were being improved when in fact they were not.
So how did that actually affect individual cases and individual vulnerable people? I mean, it's all very well to have a different thing going on in the office, but how did it affect people in the outside world, that?
Because we're actually living in this illusionary reality where from the data that is provided with the performance management, then is reported to government, and then government report those figures as if they are they are realistic figures. We get this in the hospitals, where hospitals were taking wheels off of trolleys and calling them beds to reduce the waiting figures. We get this with the police force, where the police force will then attend to more minor skirmishes rather than doing empirical investigation of more serious crimes so that they can increase their figures. And with the Baby P, with the Victoria Clumber case and Baby P case, what you had was a manipulation of the data. So, for example, you would have in the Baby P case, the social worker then would go on visit, didn't actually make contact, didn't ask any sort of challenging questions, but was able to tick the box to say they've made X number of visits. So that gives the impression that, you know, she was doing an empirical management of that particular case.
Now, I understand there was also a certain training organisation which was involved with several of the key people at Haringey as well.
There has been some research to link common purpose to the Baby P case. Now, interestingly, they've not been able to make that connection, and that's because that actual connection took place, the foundation took place under the Victoria Clumby case. The then Assistant Director of Children's Services was Carol Wilson. And Carol Wilson was common purpose trained. She actually had the common purpose matrix training in 1995, 1996. So there with the Assistant Director, you had that embedding of that kind of mindset, and that cascaded itself down through children's services.
So what is that mindset, that common purpose mindset? I mean, this matrix training sounds almost a bit scary if you've ever seen the film.
Well, I've not had the training myself. I don't have a full understanding of that. Maybe that's something that you can investigate more thoroughly.
What would you like to see change as someone who's actually been there on the inside in this specific social services department? What would you like to see change to actually make the public money that's being spent on social services deliver for the general population?
I think the key thing that needs to be changed is the organisational paradigm. You know, there's a mindset that's been embedded, and the mindset remains there. So it doesn't matter that, you know, you've got new assistant directors and director John Colclough, etc., that will come in. The mindset is very much embedded. So it's the organisational paradigm that needs to be changed. And by that, what I mean is that the organisation basically says as it does what it says.
Jackie Thompson there speaking to me a couple of weeks ago. Jackie worked at Haringey Social Services in the back office and really wanted to just flag up some of the issues that she found while she was working there. Now, a new taxi system is today being introduced in Bristol.
My name is Nick Finn. I work for a company called Time to Taxi. We're in Bristol launching a mobile phone application, which is for the public hire drivers, the Hackney drivers in Bristol, which are the blue cabs. It's basically just utilizing GPS technology and allows a member of the public to press a button on their mobile phone which just basically says, pick me up here. And it alerts the taxi driver to the fact that they want a pickup. And the taxi driver drives straight to them. The beauty of the system being that the passenger can watch the taxi driver come straight towards them on the GPS map, so they don't have to, you know, they can avoid the adverse weather conditions, and obviously it also offers safety to the vulnerable groups who might be stood out on the streets, like young girls. They can just do it from a sanctuary somewhere and watch the taxi come and know when he's outside. And of course, the other great thing about it is all of our taxis are regulated by the council with regulated prices, so everyone knows they're getting a safe service as well.
Now, there are different types of taxis, aren't there? Can you just run us through those? Because some, you know, you have to go to like a little cab firm in the high street, and others are the ones, the blue cabs, that will turn up at Temple Meads and queue up at the cab ranks, etc.
Exactly, yeah. There's private hire and public hire. The private hire taxis can only work via a pre-booked ride, but the public hire can pick up from ranks and pick up off of the street. But currently, the public hire just work off of the ranks and from being held because they have no way of taking bookings. So what the system does, it effectively offers them the opportunity to take a booking, and for the public to be able to book them to come to their house, or, you know, if they're at the football ground or at the airport, they can just call one of these blue taxis.
Now, isn't this part of a sort of a bit of a war between the two types of cab drivers? And the technology has caught up, so people are using their mobile phones and possibly other applications to phone these private hire firms, and the blue cabs in Bristol here anyway on the cab ranks are just stuck there and not getting the work because they haven't caught up with the technology yet.
That's exactly right, yeah. I mean, the ranks are quite full. In fact, I'm at Temple Meads at the moment, and there's a number of cabs sat on the rank waiting for the next train to turn up, and this should hopefully get them out on the streets and get them competing with the private hire firms.
Can you tell us what the cab market is more generally around the country? Because I know you're a national organisation. We're in the middle of a recession. I would have thought that the cab drivers who are having, you know, quite difficult margins to make it profitable, you know, maybe only taking £5 fares and £6 fares, you know, a few of those in an evening, is not really going to pay the bills.
Exactly. I think that's one of the major issues, because the costs mount up. I mean, the guys have... that they've had to respray their cars blue, and I think the cars can be quite expensive in themselves, and now they have to pay permits to come to Temple Meads, so, and obviously insurance costs are high, petrol costs are high, so all of their costs are increasing, yet the fares seem to be dwindling and going more towards the private hire who are offering greater competition. So this should really get the blue taxis back onto a level playing field.
Nick, how do people get hold of this application? Because obviously not everyone's got one of these smartphones with an Android or whatever they're called. You know, is there an alternative where you can just literally phone up a number and get this service some other way?
At the moment, there isn't. We're not doing bookings via the telephone, but we will have a booking service available later down the line. But at the moment, I think it appeals to a wide portion of the public, because I think although you're right, a lot of people don't have that technology, but equally a lot of people do, so I think you know, it opens it up to a wide portion of the public.
Okay, so where do people go to actually download this little app for your smartphone, assuming that you've got one?
Yeah, on the smartphone you can download it. I think on the iPhone you just download it in the App Store, and on any other Android phone you can download it from the Play Store. And the name of the application is Time to Taxi. It's all one word, the two being the number two. And as I say, it's available on the App Store's name.
Well, there's the entrepreneurial boffin behind it all, Nick Finn there, telling us about that new system for ordering up cabs. No Jeff Sparks this week, but Jason Yannakopoulos is here with the weekly What's On Guide.
Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday the 9th of November, the Complete Stone Roses will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 6:30pm. Also on the 9th of November, John E. Vistick Experience will be performing with support from Jim Johnston and also the Streetcars at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. on to Song of the Week, and I present Super Heavy. This is a supergroup featuring Mick Jagger, Dave Stewart, Joss Stone, Damian Marley, and A.R. Rahman. They formed in 2011 and released a self-titled album the same year. And here is a song from that album titled The World Keeps Turning.
Now is what? Nice to be important, but important to be nice, so just da-da-da-da.
Tell me, love, what would you say if I came to you on Judgment Day and I laid out my life? How did I do for you, love? Was I a lover, or did I choose to fight? Did I embrace my brother? No color, no shine, take me love.
I've
been waiting all day long.
Life goes along.
When the night falls, I'll still be standing strong.
Your stripes keep on burning.
When the morning will still be holding
let your
on.
Heart stay
oh,
strong.
Oh, yes, we will, yes.
Let your
Heavy with The World Keeps Turning from their self-titled album. You can also check out more about them on www.superheavy.com. Moving into Saturday, the 10th of November, Mike Peters of the Alarm fame will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol, as part of his Red Poppy 30th Anniversary Tour. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, the 11th of November, Angel Witch will be performing with support from Enforcer and also Age of Taurus at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jason, and thanks, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. You can sign up for our podcast from the website dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for a Bristol Bully Watch helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling.
And I'm Jason Yannopoulos.
Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, and until the same time next week, goodbye.
And one fell off.
Two blind jellyfish, two blind jellyfish, two blind jellyfish sitting on a rock.
Another one fell off.
One blind jellyfish, one blind jellyfish, one blind jellyfish sitting on a rock.
And another one fell off.
No blind jellyfish, no blind jellyfish, no blind jellyfish sitting on a rock.
And one jumped on. Hooray! One blind jellyfish, one blind jellyfish, one blind jellyfish sitting on a rock. Another one jumped on. Hooray! Two blind jellyfish, two blind jellyfish, two blind jellyfish sitting on a rock.
Another one jumped on. Hooray!
Three blind jellyfish, three blind jellyfish, three blind jellyfish sitting on a rock. And one fell off.
Two blind jellyfish, two blind jellyfish, two blind jellyfish sitting on a rock.
And another one fell off.
One blind jellyfish, one blind jellyfish, one